Teachers Netter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA 1977 on Twitter.
Nailers Netter, just talking to teachers.
Okay, good evening, everybody, and welcome to Nailers Natter. This is Bernie Kay, guest presenter for Phil this week, and I am really delighted to be interviewing Drew Povey on his book, The Leadership Factor. Now, just a bit of an anecdote, I used to work with Drew. I'm a really close friend of his and I've known him for many, many years. So it's been a really exciting couple of weeks preparing for this interview. So I'm sure listeners will be very familiar with you from your television appearances, Drew, and your books and your public speaking engagements. But could you just tell listeners a little bit more about your career and your journey to this point?
Absolutely, Bernie. First of all, it's brilliant to be on here with you. The moment I knew I was doing it with you was happy days. And it's been lovely to reconnect. I've not spoken to you for a couple of months. But my journey's a bit of a strange one, Bernie, I suppose. I suppose most people's journeys are strange, aren't they? Started off in sport, which I loved. I was always a huge lover of sport, rugby league, which for anyone who's not near the M62 corridor has probably not seen a great deal of it, but it's a wonderful sport. And I started coaching at an early age and just fell in love with that idea of working with a team, of developing young people. Very quickly, I got moved up through the ranks, I suppose, of coaching, and eventually was working with the first team at Warrington Wolves, which was kind of everything. It's like all your Christmases come at once. But I was fascinated again about how a coach can work with a group of players and connect with them and get the best performance out of them. And at this time, obviously, I'm doing my studies as well. And there were two subjects I seemed to just be good at school, or the two subjects I was best at. And that was PE and RE. PE because of the PE, and the RE, I don't quite know where that came from, other than the fact that, I suppose, in RE, if you can argue a point, you can't be too wrong, which I quite like, thinking about things and arguing the point. So I was studying those two at A level, studied those two in my degree. I've got possibly the weirdest degree in the world, which is PE, sports science, theology, philosophy, and RE, all rolled into one, which is a very eclectic mix of disciplines. But I really enjoyed that. And at the end of that, I thought, well, what am I going to do? Do I want to go into sport full time? Wasn't sure about that, even though I loved it. And then somebody suggested teaching, and I thought, well, that's got to be very similar to coaching, and looked at becoming a PE teacher, and that was full. So I did apply last minute because of the funding for PGCEs, and ended up becoming, of all things, an RE teacher, to the great joy of lots of my friends who would say, do you know all the words to come by R and all things bright and beautiful? Have you got a rainbow guitar strap and a tambourine and all the bits that my mates found very amusing? But I loved it. It was a brilliant subject to teach, and I was kind of in my element. And the first thing I noticed in teaching when I went into that, and I was doing my sport in the evenings and at the weekends as well, was that there was so many direct comparisons, Bernie, between the two. You know, working with a group of young people, trying to get the best out of them, trying to connect with them, trying to find that key to unlock their potential, and was using a lot of things in sport and a lot of things in education. Then my career kind of moved forward and I went into leadership. And then again, I just found these comparisons that what a leader's doing with a group of people is the same as what a teacher's doing, which is the same as what a coach is doing in sport. So I was kind of using these various ideas. And then as my leadership career kind of grew over time and I was getting various opportunities to do things, I was finding more and more parallels. I was still working in sport, and then was reading lots of material and eventually started producing some of my own material, and then started working in other sectors as well, where I'd go out and do talks, particularly when I was at Harrop Fold School. You know, I'd be sent out to do talks with people in the police and the NHS with models I've written that have been based in education and sport. And really, that's brought me to where I am today, working still in sport, still in education, still with the police, NHS, and of course some really big businesses talking about this thing called leadership.
Yeah, and I have to say I've been privy to many of your Year 11 pep talks and sporting metaphors and motivational speeches at the last minute with Year 11 where you've kind of G'd them on. And I always remember being kind of a recently qualified teacher sitting in front of you and thinking, I don't know if I'd ever get to that stage in my career where I could lead a year group or lead a school. I think it's not something that came naturally to me, but I think it's something I've definitely learned. But with that in mind, what is the leadership factor?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I'd say, Bernie, is I don't think any of us start off going, well, I can do that thing. I think we might want to do it, but I don't know whether anybody goes, well, I've just got this leadership thing. I think we all have to learn it, and we're all should be learning it all the time. And that's what I noticed, you know, what is it that leaders do? And trying to unpick that and trying to dissect it and trying to look at the various parts that I suppose make up what leadership is. And I suppose I'm still not there yet in terms of knowing exactly what it is. What I do know is I don't think leaders are born. I think we might be born with certain characteristics that help us do leadership, but I think most of the characteristics that we have will help us to be a leader. But it's how we carry on learning and how we use what we've got to be the best leader or the best version of a leader that we can be. And the beautiful thing I think about leadership and the leadership factor itself is that that's different for different people and it's different for different circumstances. And even though I've worked with hundreds of leaders over the years, I can genuinely say no two leaders I've worked with have been the same. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of crafting your strengths and the things that you do and making that into something where you can help to lead others through whatever it is they're going through.
Yeah, I'm just interested because I always kind of looked at you as a you know, a quite an inexperienced teacher and thought, this guy's been born with this. Who do you think were really your role models and how did you really learn to get that skill? Was it through modelling? Did you kind of just sit back and observe others?
I would say it's probably all of it. You know, when I was at school, I really struggled. My first experience of leadership was when I was made captain of the school football team. I was actually a better football player than I was a rugby player, which is bizarre why I went into rugby. But I suppose that was the first time I was given that responsibility. And I just felt I had to learn about it. I had to understand it. And like I said before, I don't think anybody's born with this stuff. I really don't. I think we're born with strengths and ways in which we operate and we cultivate those over time. But I've been so fortunate, Bernie, that I've worked with some incredible leaders, you know, in sport, some incredible people that have been generous with the time and allowed me to ask really stupid questions. Why on earth are you doing that? And kind of learning what they're doing and trying that for myself and going, well, that really didn't work, but actually that did work. And kind of, yeah, modeling people in sport, modeling people in education, you know, seeing a great teacher in a classroom. I mean, I say this, I'm quite well quoted on this, that I think teachers do make great leaders. Because if you think about what you do with a class of young people, you know, you challenge them, you support them, you work on getting them to believe in themselves, you take them on a journey, you sell messages, you influence them, you know, all those things are what leadership is. So if there is a great teaching ground, no pun intended, maybe pun intended, to become a great leader, I think education and teaching does that really well. But of course, throughout my career, working with people like Ian Hopkins, Chief of Police at Greater Manchester, oh, you know, he teaches me so much in our conversations we still have now. Tony Smith, really good friend of mine, the very well-renowned rugby league coach, Stuart Pearce, who I'm really good friends with. You know, what he's taught me about leadership in the last few years has been incredible. I've just been really fortunate. And also I would say it's not just about meeting people and observing it and seeing great teachers in classroom and great coaches or great leaders in businesses, both public and private. I think that you can learn so much, Bernie, by picking up a book and reading about great leaders like, you know, a Howard Schultz at Starbucks, what he did there, or a Bill Gates or a Sir Richard Branson. You know, all these people have so much that they're willing to record down. And you can read about this stuff. You can watch documentaries on them if you're willing to put yourself in that learning mindset to go, well, I want to know more about this. So I'm going to observe it. I'm going to learn about it. And then the key bit is going and trying those things and seeing the bits that work for you. And of course, as I said before, the bits that don't.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think I'm certainly one of those people that likes to read about it and then kind of try it out for myself. I think it's always easy in the theory, isn't it? And it's so much more difficult in real life. But I think the theory and going back to that and just having that as a basis to build yourself up and scaffold yourself to the next steps is always well worth the effort, definitely. Now, just moving on to the next question, Drew, you quote that the road to great leadership begins in the ability to get curious. Can you tell us more about this? And is this the end of the road, just getting curious about things?
I would say it's the start of the road. If you pick up what we've just been discussing there, you know, we're curious about what other people are doing. You know, from a very young age, I was curious about when a coach comes in at half time and gives a certain message, did it work? Didn't it work? You know, why was he saying that? Why didn't he say that instead? And I think having that curious mindset is the bit that allows you to dig deeper. And rather than just like copying people's behaviours, which I think there's a real danger in doing that. You know, people will read a book and go, well, this is what we need to go and do in leadership terms. Or people will watch a leader they really admire and go, I'm going to pick up everything they do and just mimic that thing. And of course, that's not going to work because the context isn't the same and the character of the person isn't the same. So there's a real danger. I think it's about understanding what they're trying to do, how they're trying to do it, and probably in the words of Simon Sinek, why they're trying to do that thing. And if you can get into being curious and not just taking the first answer. So we can watch, you know, I remember when I went down and watched Warren Gatland the first time I met him, and he was coaching Wales. And I just watched what he did. And I think you could just pick up what he did. He's very softly spoken. He walks slowly through the crowd. He talks to everybody. He's gaining an understanding of where people are at. And then he kind of fixes his formula as a result of it. You could look at that and go, well, you just, you know, that's going to work for everybody. And of course, it doesn't. What he's doing is he's observing and he's learning intently about where people are. And then he's going to make a call on what the best thing is he needs to do next. Mm-hmm. And it's not until you get curious and you start to dig down the layers that you really start to understand what that person's doing. And of course, then whether it relates to you. I think too often in life, we live in a world that wants quick fixes. We're looking for the silver bullet. We're looking for the X factor. We have what the Americans refer to as a microwave mentality, which is that thing of we're not waiting for anything. We want it now.
Yeah.
And I think that happens in leadership learning. I haven't got time to wait. You know, we need results quickly. I've got to get this thing that I'm working on at the moment over the line. Give me a quick answer. I'll do that thing. Jobs. Well, of course, it's not quite like that. We've got to dig down and really get the base understanding, I suppose, or the ultimate why, to why we're operating in that way and working out the thing that will be best fit for us. And that's where I think curiosity is so powerful. Be curious, ask lots of questions, and of course, not just be curious and ask lots of questions, but be willing to wrestle with some things that you're just not going to understand at first. You're going to have to play around and you're going to have to try things. And when you try things, you're going to have to fail. And that's all part of that learning process. And the curiosity mindset is always one of the first things I say to people. Get curious and learn as much as you can.
Do you know what, Drew? As you've been chatting there, I've just been thinking back to training I've had. And, you know, I've been teaching 16 years now. at a and during which time there was a time where we celebrated quick fixes, we celebrated, you know, these quick turnarounds and things like that, because they were seen as being kind of dynamic and effective. And actually, like a couple of years ago, I had training just through the EEF on implementation, and thank God somebody has penned a piece of research that says, actually, as a leader, before you start anything, you know, you need a really strong plan, you need a process for implementation, you need to think about what could go wrong, you know, ask loads of questions, what could go wrong in this process, and try and put in kind of elements to stop that from happening. And thank God somebody has trained leaders in that kind of process in terms of school development or any kind of development, because for so long, like you say, we've probably been stamping around and getting a lot of things wrong just because we think that that's the right thing to do.
We do. And then we get caught in this mindset of, well, that's the way we do things around here. And actually, by continuing to question, continuing to wrestle with it, that's when we're not just going to get an answer. We're going to get the best answer, because we become almost like we have tunnel vision. We become prisoners of our own minds in terms of, this is the way we do things in education, or this is the way the police do, or this is the way the NHS does it. But actually, when you get new people, and that's why I love talking to NQTs and RQTs, because they're coming into, you know, the sector of education and going, well, why can't I try that? And why won't this work? And would it not work if we did it this way? And I love that, because that's when you can actually go, do you know what? We've just been doing it that way, but we've almost become conditioned to do it that way. Imagine if we did do that. And a great example of this has been during COVID, Bernie. You know, as you know me, I'm a people person. I like being around people. You know, I like having the interaction with people. And that was really difficult online. Mm. And in March, I'm kind of staring at this screen and this little green dot on the screen. And I'm going like, this is not what I'm used to doing. I'm not enjoying this at all. This is bloody hard work, and it isn't enjoyable work. But over time, because I got curious, I was kind of going, well, OK, this is the way it's going to be for a bit. So what can I do to make this the best experience for everybody? How can I learn about online delivery? What will work? What won't work? And a lot of that kind of adaptation that is part of the curiosity process, actually, there'll be a lot of failing and trying things and experimenting. And I think we forget sometimes that it's really important that we experiment, because that's how we actually learn to adapt. That's the Tim Harford stuff in his book Adapt, where we've got to be experimenting with things. And that's how we'll find, again, not just an answer, but the very best answer.
I always forget that when I have a conversation with you, I really should have a pen and paper at the side of me, because I'm going to get a bibliography, a recommended text to go away. I must go back and listen to this and write them all down. Thanks for that, Drew. So I'm just going to move on to the next question. And this is around how you can deliberately find ways to build novelty into your working life. I know you for many years have kind of built in times for your well-being, built in times you've been quite scheduled and strict around time for the gym, time for, you know, Warrington Wolves. But how can you deliberately find ways to build novelty into your working life?
Yeah, this is a huge question, particularly for a lot of people who will be working from home. And I know that won't be the case for all teachers, but everybody's experienced it. That was a really unusual time. And there's still, of course, a great number of people across the world that are working from home. One of my big bits, as you've said there, is I've always believed in having a routine. And I was reading up on some of the latest Harvard research on this, because a routine is built up of habits. And I was like, yeah, OK, there's habits you have in the morning. So I train every day. I learn for an hour every day. I walk the dog, I do mindfulness. This is all very early morning before I even start my day. And then I always get dressed for work, and I've kind of got this routine. But then I read this piece of research which said it's actually really powerful not just to have a routine, but to have a ritual. And I was going, well, what's this? Do I get the joss sticks out? Are we having a moment here with a ritual? But what it was saying was that a habit is just something that we just do. A routine is a collection of habits. A ritual is a routine that has meaning. And it's finding those things that you have in your life, like, for example, breathing exercises for me. That has huge meaning. My learning every day has a big impact on the job I do, and I find really does energize me towards learning more about this thing I love called leadership. So I think it was about building up a set of rituals, or a ritual, or a number of rituals that would actually have a big impact. And I do think that helps us. I also think we can get quite stale. So I've always changed the time that I get up. I always get up within the 5 o'clock in the morning because I like that quiet time in the morning. My phone's not going, the kids aren't out of bed. It's that one time when I'm not going to get mired, and that's when I can do some of those rituals that are going to make a difference. But also not being too rigid. So there's a bank of research in one of the universities in America, the name escapes me now, called ambiguity tolerance. And it basically says that we're not very good at dealing with ambiguity because we set these little routines and habits up and we stick to them. So one way I think we can get novelty is actually changing things up, shifting the floor from time to time, doing things a bit differently. So one of the things I did, Bernie, to do this, and I apologize to any listeners in advance because you'll probably need to get the mind bleach out of the vision I'm going to create here. But when I'm in the shower in the mornings, I will do a cold shower at the end of my shower, which I can assure you is abject misery. And I've kind of built up from doing kind of 5 to 10 seconds. I'm fascinated by Wim Hof because the guy's just nuts. If people haven't read about Wim Hof, I just love him. I love his breathing exercises, but I love his cold exposure stuff too. And I've kind of built up, but that was one way in which I was trying to change it up. And then I've kind of got to like 90 seconds of a cold shower every morning, where it's, you know, there's so many benefits to it. You do feel great after it, but you don't want to do it. And I found different ways of trying to change around my system. And I do like my system, my little conveyor belt day, where I feel I have that locus of control, actually ripping that up and doing things differently. And by doing that, I found that some of my ideas that spring to mind come at the most bizarre times when I'm doing something completely different. You know, I remember I was talking to Sean Edwards, which some people might know is a world famous rugby player. He now works in rugby union, but he did start off in rugby league. And he went to rugby union and hadn't really played a lot of union. He played rugby league. But because he came with a completely different mindset, I suppose, to anybody else in rugby union, he literally changed the way that rugby union was defending because he brought that element of novelty. So I think we can do that by teachers reading outside of teaching, playing around with our routines and rituals, doing things differently, just sparks our brains to work in a different way. And it's a bit uncomfortable at first, but we very quickly can see some benefits from it, I believe.
Yeah, I used to, I mean, you've always been really open about being part of the 5 o'clock club. And I thought, yeah, I can understand the benefits of that when you've got small children and things like that. But when they start having a bit of a lie-in, are you not tempted to just think, sod it?
Well, yes, there is. But you've got to remove the friction. It's the only way I can say it. You've got to remove the friction. So I leave my kit out every single night. The alarm goes off. No snoozing. You can't snooze. The moment you've put a bit of friction in the way, you're starting to give yourself excuses. So the kit is out. It's ready. I just spring out of bed. I get my tweet ready. The tweet goes out. The kit goes on and I make myself train. And a lot of people are like, wow, that is like dedication. I don't want to give the false impression here that I am just like skipping down the stairs, doing a little dance, excited to train. You know, many mornings I'd rather stick a hot poker in my eye than train. But I go and do it because I know the benefit of when I actually start the training and when I actually start the blood flow going through. And the training I'm doing at the moment is like a body weight type training. and there's lots of breathing within the training. And that's really good for my learning and as well. But it's the best start to the day to get my brain functioning at its best.
So I'm just curious about this. You are a massive fan of audiobooks. Is audiobooks something you're listening to during training, or do you have some serious motivational music going on in the background?
No. I don't do the. I used to do the audiobooks when I used to do a lot of weight training, but because now I've really quite got into this HIIT training, which is just horrendously painful and miserable in the mornings. But it works because I'm away from home a lot and in hotels. So, you know, you can be training in a hotel and you don't actually need any equipment. So I do that. But the moment I finish training, as I'm getting ready for the day, that's when the audiobooks go on. And again, just by me, I've read stuff in the past. I've listened to audiobooks. I've tried loads of different models. I've tried looking at the TED Talks online. They didn't really work for me, but audiobooks do. And they seem to hit and stick. And then I make notes from the audiobooks. And just by me being curious, just by me trying different things, that's the way it seems to hit and stick for me, Bernie. So that works. So I kind of stick to that, but not while I train these days.
Not while you train. Yeah, I'm a massive fan of audiobooks. I do a bit of a commute to work and I just love that potentially dead time can become a moment of learning and curiosity. And I think that's really important.
Yeah, Zig Ziglar calls it automobile university. And there was some research done on this, and the average person's commute, if you did it to and from work, this was in America, but the average person's commute, if you did listen to an audiobook, would be reading between a master's and a PhD every year. It'd be the equivalent reading for that much. So I was kind of like, well, do you know what? I'm not the brightest bulb on the tree, but I can learn. And if I do it every day, I'll get that compound effect where, you know, I have read over 550 books now on leadership, change, success and culture, which probably makes me one of the world's biggest geeks on leadership. But because I'm passionate about it and I enjoy it, it's not been any great shakes. It's just been day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, for the last 16, 17 years. I've done it every day, including Christmas Day, and it just aggregates up. And then you get the compound effect of all that learning over time.
Tell me that phrase again, Automobile University.
Automobile University by the late, great Zig Ziglar.
I love it. I'm getting that into assembly soon.
Yeah,
thank you. Right.
You won't want many of your kids driving to school, though, because they're not Bernie.
How can I weave that in? I'll think of something.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to move you on to the next question. So this is all about connection, and I think this is something that's really apt about your personality and the way you are. So connection, as we know, is hugely important, arguably most important at this time. But who can teachers look to emulate who are naturally warm and able, you know, leaders?
Yeah, I think connection is potentially becoming a lost art. And, you know, I know we call teenagers screenagers because they're constantly looking at the phones these days. I've got two of them in the house here and they are on the phones. But I think connection is that human element which we've all struggled with during lockdown because we've not been able to connect with people in the same way. It's that human element where, you know, the eyes come together and you're in that moment together. And, you know, John Maxwell wrote a great book called Everyone Communicates, Few Connect. And I just love the title of it, even though the content's really good. It's the title that's the main thing. This isn't just about communication. This is about, can you connect with people? You know, if I'm doing a speech, can I connect with the audience? Because that's got to be the number one thing. And too many people are coming from their frame of reference. But actually, we need to know where those people are coming from. And if we do understand where they're coming from, there's a great, great chance that we're going to be able to connect. And of course, this is what the best teachers do. They don't start with what they want to do and where they want the kids to go. They start from where the kids are. They meet them where they're at. this is, you know, the people that do the meet, greet and seat. And they're at the, you know, the kids are coming down the corridor and they're saying, you know, how's your auntie doing? And what about Man United at the weekend? Or, you know, how did the dance troupe go this weekend? You know, they're constantly meeting the kids where they're at. And this for me is something that we don't talk about enough in leadership, Bernie. We have got to work harder to be able to connect. And I think we learn this by looking at great connectors. And there's so many people who do it. You know when you're watching an interview on TV and like someone can be funny and they can be impressive, but you just don't feel you connect with them. Even when I'm watching I'm a Celebrity at the moment, there's certain people on there that I think really connect with the audience. I think is it Jordan, the Radio 1 DJ?
Yeah.
He's really connecting with the public at home. And it's this, and it's, I think it comes from a bit of vulnerability. I think it comes from being authentic. I think it comes from just going, here I am. But I think there are some things that we can learn as leaders. So I very often talk about the ALE principle, that's A-L-E, which basically is, I think you can connect with someone by asking them lots of questions. You know, you see a great teacher, or you see a great leader, or a great sports coach, they're going to ask lots of questions, but genuinely listen to the answer. So the A is about asking questions and shutting up, because, you know, seek first to understand before you seek to be understood. The Stephen Covey stuff, you know where people are coming from. Ask the questions, really listen to what they're saying is the L. Really listen, deeply listen, aggressive listening, lean forward, make notes, be there. And then the E stands for explore, like, take it a bit further. You know, when someone's really just giving you a token question, how are you? Mm-hmm. Oh, you're fine. They're not really bothered. Where someone goes, you know, what's happening with you today? And then you know they're listening to the answer. And then they go, oh, that's really interesting. So how do you feel about that? Straight away, those people are starting to connect. Because mm-hmm. that person's going, do you know what? They give a damn about me. And this comes back to something I talk about a lot with leaders is, caring is so important. I think I was doing a podcast, a leadership podcast, a while ago, and they asked me a question. They said, what do you think is one of the biggest leadership things that people have got to do? I said, just care. And they were like, what, is that it? And I'm like, no, this is a big thing. You know, as the saying goes, no one cares what you know until they know that you care. And I think by showing people that you care, by asking, listening and exploring, I think we can create great connections. And when you get that connection, well, that's when the relationship really goes to another level.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think compassion and empathy and all of those things are so absolutely important. And I just think back to some of the leaders that have really inspired me. And I think in my own early days in teaching, I was really awestruck by people that just knew stuff. And of course, that kind of confidence is really important. But again, the empathy has been the thing that has really stood out to me. You know, when you've had family situations at home and you're getting to work and someone's just realised that you've been through quite a bit to get into work and they can see that in your face, and that understanding, it really does make you realise that person has got your back, kind of thing.
It does, and I think it's them putting you first. Because, you know, some people, if you were late and you have got things going on at home, the first thing the leader might be doing is, I just need you in that classroom teaching, like, just shut up and get on with it. Mm-hmm. Whereas they're putting themselves to the back of the queue and they're putting you at the front of the queue. And that is powerful. That's powerful for people. And of course, teachers know that. A kid in a classroom, they might come in, they might not have the right uniform, but okay, where are you coming from? Let me meet you where you're at. That's what connection's all about, Bernie.
Yeah. I'm just thinking about the next question now, Drew. It's how important is confidence in leaders, but more importantly, how important is it to make others feel confident in themselves?
Yeah, so I get asked this question a lot because people go, okay, you've got confidence in as one of those C's, so leaders need to be confident. And I'm like, probably not actually, no, because we all have imposter syndrome. You know, some of the best leaders I've worked with, and if I said the names, I won't, because that wouldn't be fair, but if I said the names, you'd all have heard of them. they often say to me when I put my head on the pillow at night, that little voice, that doubting voice inside tells me I'll get caught out one day. I'm not good at what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And of course, Jim Collins's research from Good to Great, Built to Last, How the Mighty Fall. He's written some great books. Great by Choice, I think, is his best one. He says that level five leaders are stoic and quite quiet and reserved and humble leaders. So I don't think you do have to be the big brash knight on the horse that's coming in to save the world and to be oozing confidence. I think a little bit of confidence and a bit of reassurance does go a long way. But the big take home here is, how can you develop and build confidence in other people? This is the big thing, because that's what leaders do. Leaders get people to believe bigger and better than they thought was possible. They see things in people and they help that person to reach their potential. They encourage them to learn and grow. And, you know, we all lack belief at some point. And a really good leader will allow you to borrow their belief. There have been times when I've thought to myself, I can't do this. And somebody said to me, come on, get a grip. You know, I remember Angela, who was a cleaner at the school. She was fabulous. And I was really nervous about a talk at a really big corporate in London, one of the biggest companies in the world. And to say I was nervous, Bernie, is an understatement. And she's walked in the office, as Angela had a tendency to do, and she just said, "What's up with you?" I said, "Angela, I'm nervous. I've got this talk next week, and it's being beamed all over the world, and you know I've got to get it right, and you know it's good money for the school." And she just went, "Now listen here, Drew," she said, "these people might be dealing with all this incredible, you know, high level stuff in their world of dealing with monies and this, that, and the other." She said, "But you're in here changing lives every day. So get a grip of yourself, dust yourself down and go in there and show them what you're really about." And I remember just being like a school kid looking at her going, "Angela, I've got you. You're right. I'll go and do that exact thing." And that was her leading me and actually giving me the confidence to go and do something. And that's what I love to see when a leader or a teacher or a coach gives somebody that belief. They boost their beliefs. They put credits into their belief banks and they say, "Go on, kid, you've got it. I believe in you. Go and do that thing." And you literally see people grow. Well, there can't be many things better than that feeling for me, Bernie.
Yeah, I'm just thinking to, you know, a lot of these subject mentors and, you know, mentors of trainees that we've had in the past at our school. And I think the key to a really good trainee or a really good early career teacher is somebody that's had somebody behind them whispering those little messages of positivity in their ear. It's really important.
We all need that. We all need that cheerleader there that's going to be clapping and is kind of got you on your good days, but got you on your bad days as well. Everybody needs that. And that's why the power of connection is so important. That's why I often tweet out and put on all the social media platforms, life's a team sport. We don't do this thing on our own. No one's this island that is the, you know, all knowing, all seeing, all doing, incredible human being. Everybody's got a team of people around them. And the more people you've got and the more people that believe in you, the more successful you're going to be.
Absolutely. I'm just going to move on to the next question, Drew, and I'm going to quote from your Leadership Factor chapter on collaboration. Just seems a really good point. So I'm just going to read a quote back to you. You said, "Before you pat yourself on the back, be aware that the current situation is unlikely to last forever. Circumstances will change, people will let you down, your character will constantly be tested, and sometimes you won't meet the top standard of every leadership characteristic." So what should listeners do in these circumstances? And obviously this will be particularly pertinent right now in COVID-19 Britain. We're not all fully able to be the kind of best versions of ourselves at all times. But what should listeners do in the circumstances when they're, you know, having a situation where they're feeling like they are being tested?
I think that quote itself is quite refreshing. nobody has got life taped. No one's got it down. Nobody's got living this best life. Don't care what Instagram says. You know, we've all got our struggles. And what COVID's done for me is it's been a great leveler, Bernie, because, like, no one's got the answer to this. No one's the expert. This has been the great leveler. This has been the time when we've all had to go, well, this is a bit different. This is a bit strange. How do we navigate through this? And this is where actually everybody's idea is as valid as everybody else's. We need to work together. And it again, like I was saying before, it's about finding the best solution. This was really coming from when I wanted to put this in the book. And Laura McInerney and I talked about this for quite a while, because I really do believe that we're never as good as people say we are when we're winning, when it's all going well, when we're kind of up there and everyone's going, oh, my goodness, look at these people. But we're also never as bad as people say we are when it's gone wrong or when we're losing. The chances are you're kind of somewhere in the middle. And it's about creating that balance. Don't fall in love with yourself when it's going well and think you've got the answers. Don't become arrogant, because that's never a good thing. And it means you're not going to learn. And that's probably the time, if you do get to that point, you need to rack your queue, hang your boots up, or retire. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you're not going to be able to continue to move forward. And that should be the absolute passion and 101 of every leader. But it's exactly the same when things are going wrong. You know, when you've had a bad day and you're thinking everything's going wrong, then that's when we've also got to balance our thinking. Because both ends of the spectrum actually are not giving you an accurate reading. You're getting a really false reading. And I put a post out on Twitter probably 2 weeks ago now, and it really helped me. And it's the Martin Seligman stuff about what happens when things go wrong. Because I think when things go right, there can be a bit of arrogance, but most people sail through that. So they kind of go, well, we're going right at the moment. Let's not rock the boat. Let's not reinvent the wheel. But I think when things go wrong, that's probably when people need the support more. And I think what's good to remember during COVID are the three P's that Martin Seligman talks about. Number one, when something goes wrong, we very often personalize it. So we think either it's all my fault or it's just happening to me. Okay. Mm-hmm. The second thing we do is we think pervasively, which means we think it's affecting all aspects of our lives. We think it's, you know, hit every part of it. I'm a complete failure because this one thing didn't go right. And the third thing I think we can do is that we think in terms of permanence. We think this is going to last forever. Mm. And what I like about this is, again, particularly during COVID times, this isn't just happening to us. You know, it's happening to the whole world. I mean, this is a pandemic, which means it's a global epidemic. Like, the, you know, it's happening everywhere. Mm. Second thing is, it's not affecting all aspects of our lives. I mean, I have loved working from home more, even though I've struggled with doing online stuff. I've worked my way through that. I actually really enjoy it now. Mm-hmm. But my kids have seen me more than they have in the last 8 years. You know, they've stopped calling me Drew now and started calling me Dad again, which is always nice. But, you know, it's not just me. It's not everything in my life. There's actually lots of very good things happening at the moment. And of course, it's not going to last forever. You know, we've got a vaccine. We're coming out of lockdown. There might be some bad times. But I think it's finding that balance all the time. You know, when good times happen, enjoy them, but they're not going to last forever. And when the bad times happen, we'll get through it. And yeah, they're not going to last forever either.
Absolutely. I'm not really sure if you've covered this question, but we'll ask it anyway. How important do you think leadership is at the moment, and what advice do you have for school leaders and leaders across all public services about, you know, COVID leadership?
Well, I think leadership is the thing. Nearly every talk I've given, Bernie, and I've done over 205 talks since March now, or sessions with people, and I've been passionate to do that, to try and help out in some way. And, you know, a lot of people talk about crisis management. We need crisis management. Something's gone wrong. Let's manage the crisis. Mm-hmm. I'm saying, well, that might give you a short term bit of control. But what we really need is crisis leadership. We need to lead people through this time. you know, particularly because it's going on for a while. This is about taking people on a journey through this. So I think we need to talk more about leadership. And of course, that means then talking about the fact that leadership is about people. So we need to lead people through this crisis. It's about a vision of what the future could look like, or what online learning could look like. Let's work with people on creating that vision. And then, of course, it's selling people on the fact that we will get through this. Because I think some people can be hit with, this is the end of the world, it's Armageddon time. No, no, we will get through this. The one thing we know about human beings is that we're incredibly adaptable. We will get through most things in life. Not everything, but most things in life. So I think it's about crisis leadership. Leadership's about people, it's about the vision, it's about how we sell people and influence people towards that better future. And the final thing that I think is really important is to remember that some people at the moment are saying things like, you know, this crisis will make us, we'll be better for it, it's character building. I'm more in line with the Simon Sinek quote, which he said probably around May time this year. And he said crisis doesn't make the leader. He says crisis is the great revealer. And I thought that was brilliant, because we're going to learn more about ourselves. We'll learn more about each other. We'll learn more about our leaders during this crisis than we will when the good times are here, or when we're just kind of going through the motions. So I think that's an important thing to remember. We've learned a lot about people, and there's a lot of really good stuff in there, by the way. I've seen some incredible acts of positive human spirit, you know, people starting local radio shows for people who are in lockdown, people doing shop drops for people who might not be able to get to the shops themselves, this community spirit, people pulling together, sharing resources, people like the Oak Academy, you know, real pulling together of people in education, but in all sectors, you know, us out there, you know, cheerleaders for the NHS every Thursday. I think there's been some great things that have been revealed as a result of what we've been through. And the final thing I'd have to say on this, which has just popped in my head, is that we can't lose hope, Bernie, in a time like this. And I'm not suggesting people are losing hope, but I think we might have done initially. And hope is just such a great activator. And we will get through this. And we will learn a lot through this. And as I often say to people, when there's hope on the horizon, there'll be power in the present. And I'm extremely hopeful that this will have taught us a great deal. I think it's made us reconnect in many ways to what's important in life. I think it's made us look at how we do our jobs differently. It certainly made me reflect on my work-home balance, because, you know, my work is a big part of my life. So I don't want to say work life, I want to say work home. It's made me reflect on that. But I am hopeful that there will be huge positives to come out of this. Now, please don't think I'm saying that COVID coming has been amazing and I'm chuffed to bits. That's not what I'm saying. But I am hopeful that the world's going to be a better place because of the way that we've been revealed during this time. And most importantly, the way we've handled it.
Yeah, I think about the SLT team that I work with, and we have just, you know, put each other's hats on many occasions, and we've learned new skills, and we've just kind of developed through this process. And I think certainly it's made a lot of leaders a lot stronger than they've ever been before.
Yeah, and I think it's shown them that they're a lot stronger than they've ever been before. And when you go through something like this, it's a bit like, you know, when you step up and do a role, any role in any sector, and you do it for, you know, a term or half a term, you never go back to being the same person again, because you've had that insight, you've had that extra perspective. And what I know about this is that people have led at a higher level during this time, and people will not go back to where they were before. Life has just changed for all leaders, and I think for the better.
Yeah, hear, hear. I agree. Okay, so we're just going to wrap it up now, Drew, and what I want you to do is tell listeners a little bit about what you're working on, what you're doing at the moment, where they can find out more about your books, your leadership work, and can you also signpost listeners to your Twitter and other social media feeds?
Yeah, of course. What am I working on at the moment? Just loads of new models, Bernie. You know, I've written a lot of stuff with Forbes during this time. Not for money, of course, just to throw ideas out there that I hope will help people. Lots of new stuff coming in, maybe a couple of books on the way of different topics. In terms of getting in touch with me, on all the social media platforms, actually, at Drew Povey at Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, back on Facebook. I've not been on that for a few years, but I'm back on there. And interestingly, I'm on TikTok as well, Bernie.
What?
I know.
TikTok.
Right, there is a reason for this. Just before people think, like, Drew's having a midlife crisis, he's going to buy himself a crap old sports car and he's going on TikTok trying to do dancing. I actually did, this is brilliant, brilliantly true. I did a talk with the about 100 leaders from TikTok. And while I was on there, they were like, join the platform. And I'm like, guys, I can't dance. And they're like, no, we're maturing the platform up. And it was brilliant, actually, working with them, because talk about an adaptive, growing, organic organization. They were just like brilliant and sparky and curious and looking for different things. They were a great group of people to work with. But they were saying, look, you know, we're trying to mature the site. We think some of your stuff would work on the site. So I actually have gone on TikTok. But the major benefit, right, as well as working with these wonderful people, they've been having a mass recruitment. And of course, they've never met each other because it's happened this year and they're all working from home. But it was the dad brownie status points it got me, Bernie, because I've got to that stage in life where my kids are completely and utterly embarrassed of me. They don't want to be seen with me. They want me to walk 10 feet behind them or 10 feet in front of them. However, that all changed, Bernie, when I did a talk at TikTok.
So I am of your form of view that TikTok is all about dancing, but apparently it's not. You can speak a little bit, can you?
Oh, yeah, you can produce videos, you can put some music behind it. It's actually really cool. But it was just brilliant seeing my lads' response, where they went, do you know what, Dad? Maybe you're not such a doofus. Maybe you're not the loser that we actually thought you were when I did a talk with TikTok. Of course, and then they found out I was on it, and then they were mortified, and I've gone back to embarrassing Dad. But yes, I am on TikTok as well, Bernie, and I actually really like the platform. It is quite good fun.
So I need to have a look at this, don't I? I definitely do. Well, Drew, thank you so much. It's just to give everybody a time check. It's a Tuesday evening and I rushed home from work for this interview, knowing that I would feel fully energised by the time I'd listened to you and chatted to you. So thank you so much for giving up your time, Drew. And looking forward to any kind of book releases. Have you got any dates on them, or are they just kind of drafts in the process?
We're just working on them at the moment, so I've absolutely no idea. I hope at some point next year, Bernie, but that could go into the year after, knowing me.
Absolutely. That's just one of the things, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, thank you ever so much, and I look forward to any future interviews with you. It's been wonderful hearing from you.
Same to you, Bernie. It's always a pleasure to catch up with you.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Nailers Netter, just talking to teachers.
Teacher Development Trust section, learning from the team at TDT on best practice CPD with research.
Nailers Netter, just talking to teachers.
I'm Michelle from the Teacher Development Trust. Over the last few weeks, we've been discussing the research behind our course and resources we'd recommend from experts in the field. Today, we're going to talk more about our programme and how you can utilise this support. I'm speaking with TDT Training Lead, Bethan Hindley, about the details of our new Collaborative Inquiry course. Hi, Bethan.
Hi, Michelle.
Thanks for joining me. So, we've heard about the why and the how of Collaborative Inquiry from our TDT colleagues. And today, I'd love to share more with listeners about the details. What shape does this programme take?
So the programme is designed to work with a group of colleagues in a school, and over the space of about two terms, we'll support them to carry out a collaborative inquiry. We'll engage with key research around why it's an effective model of professional development, support colleagues to design and implement this inquiry, and come together to share findings and reflect on implications for sharing this more widely as a practice in the school. So there are three spaced workshops where colleagues will come together and we'll be discussing the progress of their inquiries as we go through.
And what was the thinking behind that structure?
So I guess there are two main things here, Michelle. Firstly, the design very much reflects what the evidence has told us about effective CPD. So it's spaced out over a couple of terms. Colleagues have a chance to go away and practice in their setting, to come back together, to problem solve, to reflect and refine their approaches. So that's a really key part of all of our programmes, is ensuring that it is really underpinned by the evidence of what we know makes effective CPD. Secondly, is we're really keen with this particular programme to work with a group of colleagues, either within a school or perhaps a small group of schools, so maybe a MAT, for example, so that we're ensuring the practice is really embedded and has the opportunity to be sustained within that setting. So with previous courses that we have run around collaborative inquiry, it was often the case that there was perhaps an individual leader or colleague who was really interested in collaborative inquiry, who would attend a course with lots of other individuals from a variety of schools, which was fantastic, and there was a real chance to share context and experiences. But in some cases, when we followed up with individuals from these courses, there was sometimes challenges with implementing and embedding this practice in schools, because there was one individual working to share this practice with a wide variety of colleagues. So we've reflected and decided that it's actually really important to work specifically with a senior leader within a school, but also to ensure that we're supporting the participants to establish this practice and really have a chance to engage with that research and the theory themselves, so that there aren't lethal mutations or challenges for the leaders with regards to implementation and not having that buy-in from their colleagues. So that's mainly the thinking that's gone behind the design here.
And finally, how can schools, both members and non-members, get involved?
So for schools that are interested in this training, they can visit the webpage, which is tdtrust.org/collaborative-inquiry-training. And that's inquiry with an E. So there is the programme brochure available on this page, and you can also register interest so that a colleague from TDT will be back in touch.
Thanks, Bethan. Listeners, as Bethan said, if you would like to find out more, do go to the TDT website and look for the TDT Learn section, where you can download a brochure to share with your leaders or register your interest.
Miller's Netter, just talking to teachers.
Podcast pedagogy. What is Phil reading this week? Podcast pedagogy. Listening to teachers.
Miller's Netter, just talking to teachers.
Okay, so welcome everybody to the podcast, and it's a welcome back to two of our guests tonight. So first of all, welcome back to Lisa. Welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having us.
No problem. And welcome back to Adrian, who, as I record this, has been on a couple of weeks ago. So popular was the podcast that he's back again. So welcome back, Adrian.
Yeah, thank you. Enjoyed the last one, so looking forward to this too.
Yeah, and we'll take a slightly different tone to the Turner, no doubt. So that's always good. Not as entertaining, I have to say, but you know, still very informative, hopefully. So, Lisa, we're going to start with you, because we don't need to do the introductory questions and tell us a bit about yourself, because if listeners want to know more about Lisa, they can go back to a podcast round about this time last year when we started talking about all the work that Lisa does, and the same for Adrian. So we'll go into the first question. So, Lisa, can you give us a little bit of background to Well Schools, what it actually is and what the thinking is behind it?
Of course, yes. So a very warm welcome to everybody that's listening. And thank you so much for making the time to listen to us. So Adrian and I are chairs of the Strategic Board for Well Schools. Well, what is Well Schools? Well, first of all, just to say, I couldn't be more excited about the prospect of a movement of schools committed to well-being in all aspects of school life, from leadership, management, culture, climate, right through to teaching and learning. I just want to take you back, because many of you will know of the Youth Sport Trust, a national children's charity that's been around for about 25 years. And basically the Well Schools movement is powered by the Youth Sport Trust, but led by schools for schools, like a movement. And I'm really passionate about the difference that this could make. And the reason it came into being was that the Youth Sport Trust and many of us as school leaders didn't want to wait for policies to change. And we knew that hundreds of schools were really passionate about wellbeing and putting this at the centre of school life. And of course, we know that there are some countries that do wellbeing in a much more serious way, like in the Netherlands, etc. And what we're hoping is that the Well School movement will be a coming together of like-minded schools, learning from each other and sharing from each other. And a Well School is one that joins with other like-minded schools to drive and ensure that wellbeing is at the heart of school life. And I'll come on to give you a little bit more detail as to exactly what that is as we go through, if that's all right.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Adrian, from a primary perspective, why does Well Schools appeal to you?
I mean, I think it appeals to me from a primary perspective the same as it would from a secondary perspective, to be honest. You know, we know as teachers, we know as parents, we learn better and we teach better when we're well, when we're healthy, when we're happy. You know, kind of well-being is like the bedrock of learning and just functioning well. So, you know, even outside of education, we know that happier employees, for example, have less time off sick, they're more productive, they're more creative. And it's no different for teaching. You know, I know that when I feel rested, when I feel like I've got lots of energy, I teach better. When I'm kind of enjoying my work more, I'm more responsive in the classroom. I'm kind of better able to handle kind of difficult situations. So Well Schools is kind of sharing best practice. Like Lisa said, it's bringing together a kind of movement of schools that are committed to putting wellbeing at the heart of what they do, sharing ideas. And ultimately, it's about collaborating. It's about kind of sharing the best of what kind of we know, the best of what we're doing in various corners of the UK, and just, you know, bring it all together on a platform and through this movement of schools. And yeah, just helping each other kind of improve what we do for the benefit of children and teachers.
Brilliant. And it's, you know, there's a lot of talk around education at the moment about various different facets and parts of you know, the holistic work of the school. And you hear a lot of discussions around curriculum. We have a lot of discussions on here about curriculum, and we have a lot of discussions around teaching and learning. At the moment, we have lots of discussions around remote learning. So Lisa, where does wellbeing fit in? Is it more important than, is it on a par with, where would you place wellbeing?
Well, first of all, I don't think you can really deliver the curriculum well if we don't attend to our students' wellbeing first. And, you know, back in the day when I was a pastoral deputy, we talked about removing barriers to learning and we used that kind of language. And actually, if you don't attend to people's wellbeing in the first place, then they can't access anything properly. And I think, you know, that's kind of what Adrian just said, isn't it? And if you think about the context for children's wellbeing and the challenges that facing us as a sector, you know, for the last few years, we've seen a decline in physical, you know, in PE, in the amount of time that kids are being active. We've seen a decline in social and emotional well-being. And more so, I think these challenges are felt in communities that suffer the greatest health inequalities and where there are real, like, social economic barriers. And well-being issues obviously affect mental health as well. And we know that there are a huge numbers on the rise of children and young people with a diagnosable mental health condition. And equally, we know that the pandemic has affected our children in that way as well. So actually, I think it's the time now to change the narrative and focus on what schools can do to address, you know, these barriers in terms of poor well-being, so that children can actually reach the potential and access the curriculum. And we're seeing an unprecedented number of staff considering their future, aren't we, in the education setting. And actually, you know, this is about really strategic stuff as well. If we don't attend to well-being, we're going to have even more staff leaving the profession. We know that there are, you know, I can't remember the figure, but I think we're on about an 84% retention rate for teaching. And also, it's not rocket science, is it, to see, you know, what's happening when women are leaving the profession kind of in their 30s. And it's because we don't really make it that easy to juggle other things like being a parent and stuff as well. So in answer to your question, you know, I don't think one thing's more important to the other, but actually it's about access. And just as we talk about literacy being an English being an access subject to all the other subjects, I think that having the right well-being in a school means that children can access the range of other things as well. Is that all right?
Absolutely. I was just doing the 2020 thing there. If I start talking and then you're on mute, which we have every week. So I've now got, as listeners will know, I've now got a fancy headset, which I use for meetings, which looks like, you know, something that's from the control center of, you know, NASA or something like that. But it's got a fancy button on to mute. So sorry, I didn't press it in time, but absolutely agree.
I thought you'd have a bit more of a Madonna type headset, you know, knowing your style, Phil.
Listen, what are you trying to say? I've got one of everything, Lisa, let me tell you. I've got a little bit of everything on this desk. Anyway, so let's move on to the next question, which is, and it's for Adrian to start with, but Lisa, you might want to come in on this as well. So there's a lot out there around staff wellbeing at the moment for obvious reasons. Now, if I just preface this by a couple of tweets that I've seen this week, which are flying around, and you do take these tweets kind of... I'm sure they're not aimed at me because I'm not important enough to have tweets aimed at me, but I've seen quite a few this week that have been, you know, how do people possibly find time to do things like podcasts, you know, when the rest of us are trying to run a school? Well, you know, I can assure you, listeners, that I am also trying to run a school at the same time as doing this podcast. But the way I see it in terms of this is, you know, this actually makes me feel better. And this actually contributes to well-being, because this is a time, you know, especially with social distancing in schools and lack of meeting times. And this is a chance to connect with fellow professionals and talk about things other than, you know, where a year eight lining up and who's in the dining room. So actually, you know, this kind of human connection, however remote it is really useful. So I'm waffling on, Adrian, to come around to the question, which is, how do you think staff wellbeing is at the moment?
So as luck would have it, the Teacher Wellbeing Index 2020, which is been produced for the last couple of years by the Education Support charity, came out today. And so there are some kind of headline figures. So 62% of education professionals say that they are kind of stressed as a result of their job, and it's much higher for senior leaders such as yourself, Phil. So 77% of senior leaders report themselves as feeling kind of regularly stressed as a direct result of their work, and senior leaders report on average clocking up 51 hours a week, which is, you know, that's starting at 8, finishing at 6. So these are kind of long days, and that's the average. So some people working way beyond that. And we also know that a significant number of education professionals experience kind of much higher levels of depression. So a third of education professionals compared to the national average, which is just below 20%. And I think the situation was bad before the pandemic. So the Teacher Wellbeing Index 2019 was not great. But the pandemic and the kind of increasing pressures in schools has just made things worse. So this year, Teacher Wellbeing Index, teachers are saying they're experiencing more difficulty concentrating, increasing rates of insomnia, and kind of greater kind of tearfulness. And just overall, the Teacher Wellbeing Index said that the wellbeing of education professionals in the UK remains significantly lower than the general population. And I just find it crazy that this is, you know, we're creating these structures and systems that are not well. So they're kind of anti-well schools in a way. And this is where we're raising our children. This is where we're educating. This is where we're teaching them the skills to flourish. And it's not okay. It's not right. And we can do much better. And I think we need to. And that's one of the main reasons I'm really passionate about well schools.
Yeah. And just to add to that, I think... You're absolutely right. You know, wellbeing hasn't been great for teachers for a long time. And I think there's two things for me. There's the pandemic, which has exacerbated issues, but there's also the way that we are being made to feel as a profession at the moment by the press and by, you know, various other bodies. It feels like we've almost not got quite as much control as we thought we had in schools as leaders to make decisions about what's right for us in our context, using, you know, the health data and advice from health professionals. But also, there just seems to be a complete lack of acknowledgement that we've all been working since March without a proper break. And yet, you know, absolutely know that how hard they're working in hospitals and doctors and nurses. And I'm not trying to compare the sectors at all. It's a completely different type of work that we've done. But we are key workers. And I think that that needs to be recognised somewhere. And I think that that would make us all feel a bit better, actually, because, you know, it doesn't matter what level people are working at. People still like that recognition. They still like that praise, whether it's public or private. And I think that that's sadly missing. I really do.
And how timely, though, that data comes out on the very day that we're doing the podcast.
I know.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
And just to add to your point, Phil, about I saw that tweet about podcasts in the evening. And, you know, I also think, because teacher wellbeing is such a kind of hot topic, and it has been, you know, for a while, we're so keen to kind of find the silver bullet about what's right for teacher wellbeing, what do we need to do? But it also means we're highly opinionated about our own wellbeing and about, you know, well, you know, just because I don't like doing a podcast and even I like to watch rubbish TV, well, do that. And if you want to be on a podcast, do that. If you want to go for a run, do that. Like, let's stop telling each other what we should do for our well-being. The reason one of the key measures for well-being is subjective well-being is because it's subjective. So what boosts my well-being is going to be different to Lisa's. So let's just, yeah, not be so opinionated about each other's well-being and just kind of, yeah, support each other at this difficult time.
I think, I don't know if it's just how tired people are, but there does seem to be quite a lot of judgmental tweets and things like that at the moment that doesn't help. Just going back to the podcast thing, I think that the bigger picture there is that actually CPD and continuing professional development is good for well-being, isn't it? So, you know, if we think about the early career framework and that kind of wraparound support and ongoing training, if people feel like they are still able to grow in some way, even during a pandemic, you feel like you're moving forward, I think that's quite motivating. A lot more motivating than feel like, you know, than feeling like you're stagnated and all you're doing is thinking about how you're going to put a lesson on Teams or whatever. So I think that there's an argument to say that actually high quality CPD is definitely contributing to well-being. And like you said, Adrian, you know, if people want to access that in their own time as well, then that's great. You know, some people live on their own. Some people don't have children. For some people, doing things that keep them busy like that is actually a lifeline, isn't it?
Yeah, and sometimes being on a podcast is a way of getting away from your children.
Absolutely.
I'm joking, of course.
Of course. Absolutely.
But it's a really interesting point that you raised there, and both of those things tonight I've done. So, you know, coming home after a day of, you know, a busy day, a great day, by the way, but a busy day, and then I've been for a run. I mean, I call it a run. As Martin Rea says, it's more of a gentle jog when I pop out. It's far from it. But then you come back and you feel energised, even if you feel better. And I feel the same way about doing the podcast. But I think, I don't know whether I could leave this bit in, but we'll discuss it anyway and we'll see. I feel like there's a little bit of a martyr complex and a superhero idea that, you know, I am working so hard as a school leader or as a teacher that I can't possibly do anything else. And anyone who isn't working as hard as me, you know, shouldn't be going out there and doing podcasts or CPD or conferences or anything like that. You know, it's almost wearing it as a badge of honor to say, look how hard I'm working to the point of exhaustion. And that's not helping anybody.
No.
I think, though, that some people do feel that exhausted, that perhaps they're saying things at the moment that they might not normally say. So I guess it's about just reframing that and just thinking, God, you must be really struggling. I hope you're all right. And think it, I always like to think if we think that everybody has got the best of intentions, whatever they're saying, and, you know, read it in that way, then you kind of feel a little bit more empathic. I'm being nice.
Yeah, it's very Mother Teresa.
You describe me.
Yeah, I to be honest, when I was in my probably early career, the thought of thinking and talking about teaching outside of teaching would have been so crazy to me. Like I was exhausted because, you know, I'd left my cushy career in music publishing and was a primary school teacher. And when I was at home, I didn't want to think about school or teaching. But you know, fast forward a few years, I get a lot of meaning and purpose and enjoyment out of having conversations like this. So, you know, it changes as well.
Yeah, of course it does. You know, the older you get, the more different you feel about things.
Yeah.
And you're probably knocking on a bit now, Adrian. You're getting to that mellow stage of life, maybe.
Well, don't start with that topic of conversation, because I happen to rediscover on the All Four app, the program Teachers. I don't know if you've both seen it, which was years and years, must be the turn of the millennium. It was about 2000, and it shows what teaching was like in 2000, which is roughly when I started. Wow, what a change. I mean, they didn't even think about teaching when we were teaching then, let alone any other time.
Absolutely.
Anyway, I feel like there's going to be an edit necessary, so I'm going to have to move on. So let's get back to the question. So Lisa, can you give us a little bit more detail on the Well Schools concept and perhaps how it can help staff wellbeing as well as students?
I can. And if you're listening to this, then I suggest that you have a look at the Well Schools platform. And in particular, there's a diagram that has kind of three pillars, which I'm going to talk you through now, but it's much better if you can see them. So if you think about kind of three pillars in a row, and the first one under the Well Schools umbrella is well-led. And earlier Adrian mentioned, you know, how many teachers were feeling stressed. Well, this particular pillar is about how you lead schools well to make sure that talented teachers do not leave or compromise their own well-being. And for teachers to be the very best they need, you know, they need the best teachers. And we've seen a massive growth in teacher well-being services. But how do schools find the right ones? How do they know what's working? How do they know, you know, where the good practice is in terms of well-led? So this is about bringing all that together, if you like, so that schools can learn from each other. And Well Schools has also got a partnership with the Bupa Foundation. And I just give a shout out to a launch that I did a couple of weeks ago with Bupa Foundation and Youth Support Trust, which is called Head to Head, where I'm connecting head teachers across the country to each other to have a cup of tea and a chat and basically support each other through this pandemic. And I launched it 2 weeks ago, and I've got quite a large number now of head teachers that have been connected to other head teachers, and they're really finding that quite useful. Anyway, moving along, so that the second pillar is well-equipped, and a well-equipped school is a school that ensures all the pupils leave each day and at the end of their time within the school with the skills and experiences they need to survive and thrive. And actually, you know, if we're honest, we don't really know what some of those skills are going to be. You know, if you think about how much technology has changed in the last year even, you know, it's really hard to predict where we might be with artificial intelligence and all that kind of stuff. So this is about helping schools learn from each other to be the very best they can be, and make sure that our children are leaving with those skills of empathy, creativity, strategic thinking, and able to find their own path in the future. And then the last pillar is well prepared. And this is about making sure that our young people are ready to learn through a focus on physical and emotional well-being, able to concentrate, able to play, able to maintain activity for all their lives, and manage stress and anxiety. Hopefully that made sense. It would probably make more sense if you could see that those three pillars. And I guess just to finish off, you know, the commitment from the Well Schools movement is that it's a free access for all schools. There's no financial cost to joining the Well Schools movement. All the schools in my trust at Bright Futures have joined it because we believe in well-being. And there's a commitment to connect schools and also to celebrate that what schools are doing well with well-being. So I'll stop talking there and you can tell me whether that made any sense whatsoever.
Perfect sense. And of course, when we put this out, we'll put it out with a graphic. So as we record this tonight, Lisa's already put that out as a graphic to publicise the podcast recording tonight. So obviously we'll put that out alongside, and we'll put that in the show notes as well. So you've got, you know, some Olicav dual coding going on there to explain that. Perfect. Okay, right. So Adrian, can you just talk to us a little bit about how you go about measuring well-being, or indeed whether that's actually possible?
Yeah, measuring well-being is definitely possible. You know, you measure well-being by asking people about their well-being. It's literally as simple as that. And there are but one of the first things schools need to do is decide what they want to measure exactly. So it might be that you've got an intervention going on in schools and you want to measure the impact of that intervention on either, say, an individual or a group of children. It might be that you want to kind of measure the well-being of a whole cohort of students and kind of take snapshots in the year, and you kind of track their well-being to see how it changes over time. But once you've decided kind of what it is that you want to measure, and whether it's pupil well-being or staff well-being, you then choose a survey. And there are lots of different validated surveys out there. And by validated, I mean that kind of psychologists, scientists have shown that these surveys reliably give you the information that you want. And then you ask people. So you can use lots of different tools. I personally wouldn't use things like SurveyMonkey or Google Forms, because I've tried them in the past and it just becomes a nightmare in trying to analyze the data. At my school, we've used a tool called Bounce Together. It's an online platform and people log on and then they take their surveys. And then it kind of helpfully analyzes or kind of graphically displays the data for you at the end. Then importantly, you've got to share the results with whoever's taken the kind of surveys, because it's ultimately it's their data. So if your staff have filled in the staff wellbeing survey, then you need to share the results with them. And that is, you've got to share it warts and all. Like we've just done a staff wellbeing survey and I've literally just crunched the numbers today. And some things have improved and that's great. You celebrate those successes, and some things have gone down, and those are the areas that we need to work on. And that's the next important step. You then work with the pupils or the staff to improve the areas that you're not so great in. But it's got to be that kind of two-way involvement. It's not just a done-to process. And then after that, it's a cycle. You continue the cycle. So you try and improve the things that you scored not so well on. You try and maintain the things you're doing well, and then you measure again, and then you see how you're doing, and hopefully things are kind of heading upwards in the right direction. I think the difficult thing with measuring well-being now, and it's still a very valuable tool to do, is that you've got this massive global situation happening, which is going to skew the results. So you've just got to bear in mind the many variables that will affect staff and pupil well-being.
Yeah, and just to add to that, in my trust we do regular kind of staff culture surveys, and although we don't call them wellbeing surveys, but there are definitely questions in there that allow us to understand how our staff are feeling, how motivated they are, how much they feel that they belong, and all that kind of stuff. And also in Greater Manchester, when we did the Greater Manchester Mentally Healthy Schools and Colleges program, we kind of measured well-being through that as well. And we're still waiting to collect the last lot of data to see, because sometimes when you do some interventions, you don't always see the lasting impacts of things until a little bit later down the line. So we're keen to make sure we can see whether or not things have had sustainable impact. And also in Greater Manchester, Phil, we've done something called the Life Readiness Survey with Year 10 students across the board. And although it's about whether these students think that they're ready for life after school, but there are questions in there that do link to well-being. So for example, there's one that sticks in my memory that's about kind of how hopeful our students feel, and there were some worrying mixed results around that. So in Greater Manchester we're really quite excited because we're looking at a well-being survey. They're working with David Gregson. We're quite excited about that. And I agree, I think you can measure it. And actually, there are some countries, aren't there? And Adrian knows more than me about this subject, but there's some countries that absolutely measure well-being. And it's a non-negotiable. They measure it. It's robust. And it's something that they do every term, every year, because these countries are more focused on the well-being of their children than anything else. I'm thinking about the Netherlands here. Adrian, I don't know if you want to say a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so there are some countries, so the Netherlands, Southern Australia, Dubai, kind of regularly survey student well-being, and I have done for kind of a number of years. And what that means is, I think the problem in the UK, there's no national measure of, say, children's well-being. So schools will all be using slightly different measures. And, although for an individual context, that's probably fine, you can't really compare, like nationally, you can't compare regionally. So I wrote a blog for the What Works Centre for Wellbeing about this. And something that I would be in favour of would be In the same way that the Office for National Statistics kind of measure adult wellbeing kind of routinely and have done since about 2012, I think, I'd like to see a national measure of children's wellbeing that could be administered in schools. And then you can see nationally, like, who's doing well, what schools are doing well, what can we learn from those schools, what areas might children's wellbeing be low, is there anything we can do differently there to support those children? So yeah, that's what I would like to see, is the UK routinely measuring children's wellbeing.
Yeah, agreed. Have you, Adrian, have you had a look at the State of the Nation 2020 Children and Young People's Wellbeing Report that came out in October?
I did. I can't remember the headlines. I've seen the latest Good Childhood Good Childhood Report 2020, which is more recent, but it's similar findings, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is. And one of the things that the report pulls out is the importance of relationships. And some of these things, they're not new, are they? They're things that we all know. But it's good to highlight them, I guess.
Yeah. And just on that point, Lisa, so we use the Good Childhood Index as our pupil wellbeing survey in our school. And some of the questions are about general wellbeing. So your sense of life satisfaction, your physical health, questions like that. But then there's more school specific. So it would be like asking about your relationships with your teachers and your relationships with your classmates, the children in the wider school, how you feel about the school environment, things like that. And that can give you some really useful information. So, we're a junior school, so we get children transitioning up from infant schools. And it might be that the year threes show a lower score on the relationship with the teachers. And that makes complete sense. They're coming to a brand new school, new teachers, new building. And that, you know, might highlight to a school like ours, okay, we need to do a lot more work, say, on transition, so we need to work more closely with infant school. But that's why this data, I think, can be really valuable. It's not just about measuring well-being, it's what you do with it afterwards. It's kind of what actions are you taking to improve the lives of children and teachers and families in your school community. That's the whole point. It's about improvement of people's lives.
Absolutely. And you know, I guess there's never been a better time to sign up to the Well Schools movement then, because, you know, like you said, this has been a really challenging time. There are schools all have to work on this stuff. So why do it on your own? You know, why not join a movement where you can learn from each other, you can celebrate the journey, you know, it can be fun. You can get all the staff engaged in sharing content on the Well Schools platform. And everybody learns from each other. And, you know, there's real kind of good feeling, isn't there, in collaborating?
Yeah, definitely.
So if you've not signed up, go and have a look now.
Absolutely do. And there'll be links in the podcast show notes to talk about that. Now, we are going to turn this podcast around pretty quickly. So as you listen to this, hopefully we'll be getting very, very close to Christmas. So I thought it's quite timely on the day when the new tier system has been announced and the plans for what is and what isn't allowed at Christmas have been announced. So both of you, maybe I'll go to Lisa first with this one. Have we got any tips for teachers listening on how to get through to Christmas?
Wow, how to get through Christmas or how to get through to Christmas, because both things are quite stressful in some people's houses, aren't they? How to get through to Christmas? Well, first of all, I think it's about pacing yourself. So we've got a lot of people, like we've said already, working quite a lot of hours. And if you think about this with an analogy of a sports game or a race, we've still got a long way to go, actually. We've still got nearly a month, haven't we, until we break up. So I think it's about pacing yourself. It's about making the most of time off and weekends and relaxing. And it's also about not putting too much pressure on yourself of what you can achieve between now and Christmas. You know, the shops are not open. People are not necessarily going to be expecting the same level of Christmas presents and things like that as normal years. And actually, I think this time has taught us that some of those material things are just not important. So I think it's about taking the pressure off. Some schools are still doing kind of Christmas festivities and Christmas plays and things like that, and others are not. And I would just say, you know, what do you need to do to try and keep a bit of Christmas spirit? And actually, what are those things that you can maybe let go this year and perhaps use that time in other ways? Adrian, do you want to add?
Yeah, I'd just echo some of what you said, Lisa. Conserve energy. Like, just strip back anything that you don't really need to do right now. I'd also say, like, make your home a haven. You know, these cold, dark winter nights. I love that Danish concept of hygge. Like, get the mood lighting going. Get some really nice food in. Have things to look forward to. So, like, plan some nice kind of autumnal walks. Get some really good movies lined up. So, like, just have things to look forward to outside of work, because work is going to be really tiring. Conserve energy, have good things to look forward to, and ultimately just kind of know that 2021 will be better than 2020. Like, we don't know when this vaccine is going to come and save all our lives, but ultimately there is light at the end of the tunnel. 2021, there's so much more to be kind of hopeful for. So just keep in mind that although Christmas feels like a long way away, actually, before we know it, we'll be at Christmas. We can just slump on the sofa, eat good food, watch rubbish movies, and then we can kind of go into 2021 with just a bit more hope and optimism that things will slowly but surely start to get kind of much better than they have been.
Absolutely. And the other thing that I'd say is sometimes some people, everybody, feels that Christmas is a bit of a pressurised time because you've got to get round to see different family and friends, and sometimes it's quite a busy time. Well, actually, you have, for the first year ever, got the perfect excuse, because you can just say, I'm really sorry, but I just feel like I need to isolate. I just don't want to mix. I don't want to, you know, put you at risk. And you can basically batten down the hatches and eat as many Lindor balls as you want and not leave the house. I mean, that's the strategy that I'm going with, Phil.
Well, very similar. I mean, we've been doing that already in our office. We've been going through, it's not as high class as those Lindor balls you're talking about. We've gone through about two tubs of Quality Street already.
Nice.
but speaking of Christmas, and if anyone's listening is looking for a stocking filler, then Adrian's book with Emma Kell, of course, which is The Teacher Wellbeing and Self-Care, which we looked at a few weeks ago on the podcast, would be highly recommended as a stocking filler, which is, as Craig Barton would say, available from all good bookshops and some evil ones as well. So, yes, make sure you get a check that one out. Okay, right. Conscious of everyone's well-being this evening, let's wrap this up with just a signpost into any website and social media and blogs and anything else we can signpost listeners to find out more about you and about everything that we've talked about tonight. So, Lisa, do you want to go first?
I will, yeah. So just to say, I have read Adrian's book and I thought it was really good. What's really nice is that it's quite small, so it's an easy read, and it's something that you can keep going back to read different tidbits and things like that. So I would definitely recommend it. So yeah, to find out more about my work and me, if you go to either the Bright Futures website or the Alliance for Learning website, allianceforlearning.co.uk, and follow me on Twitter at LisaFathersAFL. The other thing in terms of a tip for Christmas is that Christmas Chronicles 2 is due out yesterday, actually, but we're saving it for weekend. So if you've not seen that, that's something to look forward to. And the last thing that I want to say is that, remember, it only takes one teacher or one coach to change the world. And it only takes one person to improve somebody else's well-being. So if we all make tiny little efforts, then they will add up to one huge movement, like the Well Schools movement. Off you go, Adrian.
Thanks for the plug of the book. So I'm at Adrian Bethune on Twitter. My website is www.teachhappywith1h.co.uk, and there's vlogs on there. There's free resources and stuff you can download. And just get onto the Well School platform. It's well-school.org. And you'll see me and Lisa on there. We share resources, we leave comments and help people out. So yeah, hopefully see you on there soon.
Well, thank you again, Adrian, and thank you again, Lisa, and you're both welcome back anytime for your third appearance, which comes, as listeners will know, with the Nailers Natter match ball. So we'll look forward to that into 2021. Thank you both.
Thanks for having us, Phil. Bye.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA 1977 on Twitter.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.